90.3 FM.
Another reliable communication channel.
Thanks for tuning in to CKUT 90.3. It's been DJ Jab.
Directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
The outsized abuse is meant to silence us. It's meant to intimidate us. And they hope that by doing this, we will feel ashamed. We will feel scared for ourselves, for our safety, for our family. And we will remove ourselves from the public conversation.
Gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse happens every day. How in the world does one survive as a woman, girl, or gender diverse person online? I'm Andrea Gunrad from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What, a podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Facebook, Twitch, Discord, Tinder, X, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Reddit, LinkedIn, Zoom. Digital life is real life. And digital spaces aren't safe for everyone. Whether you're on social media, streaming platforms, dating, messaging, and meeting apps, or on game sites, if you're a woman, girl, or two-spirit, trans, or non-binary person, you're at greater risk of hate, harassment, and violence. 1 in 5 women experience online harassment in Canada. Young women, racialized women, and 2SLGBTQIA+ people are amongst those who face higher risks. Canada's rising hate crimes is in large part due to increased hate in digital spaces against women, 2SLGBTQIA+ people, and targeted ethnic and religious groups. Gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse happens every day. It's pervasive, urgent, and growing. You deserve to be safe and free from harm. Over coming months, we're delving into this with leading experts and content creators, releasing in-depth episodes every single week. We'll talk about the problem and what we can do to change it. We'll offer practical tips to help you in your digital life, and we'll talk about what it means to take back the tech for all of us. There are no easy answers or quick fixes, but one thing is clear: power, safety, support and rights to thrive today and tomorrow won't be our reality until we're safe everywhere, including digital spaces. Today I'm with Nina Jankowicz, author and internationally recognized expert on disinformation and democratization. She's vice president at the Center for Information Resilience and has advised governments, international organizations, and tech companies. She led the U.S. Disinformation Governance Board and has had fellowships at the Wilson Center, researching the effects of disinformation on women and freedom of expression around the world. A note about content. This episode addresses gender-based violence.
I am by trade a disinformation researcher and author. Something important about me is that I have been the subject of a national and in some cases even international online hate campaign because of a role that I held in the Biden administration for a very short time, combating disinformation. On a more positive note, I've published two books, one on Russian disinformation called How to Lose the Information War, and the second one on being a woman online, which is called How to Be a Woman Online, and takes readers through kind of a play-by-play in how to be secure and safe online, but also how to deal with some of the things that we encounter on women as women online that are unique to our experience that I can confirm my husband and male colleagues don't deal with. Even though I've been, you know, a professional in Washington, D.C. for the past over 10 years now, I'm sad to admit, I still like to do fun things. And though I recently became a mom, one of my favorite pastimes in my spare time is participating in musical theater. This is something my haters online love to make fun of, but I am not easily dissuaded from my nerdy hobbies. So keep it coming, haters. Keep it coming.
Your book, How to Be a Woman Online, is great, and it's a practical read. How did it even start?
The book, How to Be a Woman Online, actually stemmed from some broader research that I did at the Wilson Center with a group of women who were interested in unpacking gendered disinformation and online abuse in the context of the 2020 U.S. election. There had been a lot of work done looking at specific platforms or specific individual women, women versus men, but there hadn't been a lot that was A, longitudinal in terms of more than just a specific couple days online, and also cross-platform. And so we did this pilot study comparing 13 women in mostly the United States, but we did include three women from Canada, the UK, and New Zealand across various political parties, age groups, racial and gender diverse folks. What we found was really staggering. Over 330,000 pieces of gendered abuse or disinformation across a two-month period targeted at these 13 candidates. Short period of time, wide look at platforms, and a very small amount of subjects. And I think it confirmed what we all knew, but we didn't quite know how visceral and how bad the problem was until we had to look individually at each of these pieces of abuse to kind of categorize them. We found also that so much of the abuse that we see online goes undetected. And a lot of the stuff that we found, we wouldn't have found if we hadn't done such in-depth research looking at kind of the conversation around these individual candidates for office and understanding the nicknames that abusers gave them, some of which would be kind of undetectable if you weren't searching for them. So this is where kind of my skepticism about artificial intelligence comes in, right? Because a lot of people are saying, oh, you know, AI can solve abuse. It can find it so easily. It can categorize it. It can, you know, penalize the abusers and take out human content moderation out of the equation. Without humans looking at this stuff, we would have missed probably, I don't know, I can't give you a specific number, but a good majority of it. And so we called this malign creativity because a lot of the abusers were very purposely using what we call the mimetic language or even images in order to avoid detection. For instance, using images where they could use text so that the classifiers that were looking through content online didn't find what they were posting about. Instead of calling someone Jews, for instance, they could write juice, J-U-I-C-E, and the AI wouldn't find it. This is the type of thing that women are dealing with so much. So we'll report something and it goes completely undealt with because generally the computer on the other side doesn't understand the implication. And sometimes the people don't even understand the implication. The problem is really, really much worse than I think many people realize that it is because we are missing so much of the conversation and the research that gets done when we just put a search term for whore or rape into the search box.
Let me ask you a basic question. Why does hate and harassment and abuse happen online? What's the goal of it?
In my experience, both my personal experience and my research experience, talking to women through focus groups, but also looking at the quantitative data, I think that people really like to try to push women out of public life. The outsized abuse is meant to silence us. It's meant to intimidate us. And they hope that by doing this, we will feel ashamed, we will feel scared for ourselves, for our safety, for our family, and we will remove ourselves from the public conversation. Because when we looked across these many different platforms, six different platforms during the Malign Creativity Study, we found the large majority of the abuse was on Twitter. And the reason that it was on Twitter is not just because it's a popular platform. It is because, we hypothesize, people like to yell at their targets, not just about their targets. If they're on a platform like Parler or Truth Social, let's say, it doesn't have the impact that it has on the individual, the woman at the receiving end, seeing it. It's not as fun to talk about somebody behind their back. It's fun to shout directly at them. And I think we're going to see that shifting as, you know, people coagulate around one platform in the post-Twitter era. People went as far during the abuse campaign against me, or during the height of it, I would say it's still going on. People went as far as to comment on pictures of a cat that is long dead that I had posted on Facebook in a public kind of photography forum. They were in a Facebook group or on a Facebook page, and they saw and searched for my name on Facebook and saw this and commented on pictures of this dead cat so that they could get to me. Similarly, you know, they'd send emails to me, to my various addresses at the Wilson Center or at Syracuse, where I, Syracuse University, where I'm an adjunct professor, all sorts of things. And the idea, again, is to intimidate us. It's really shocking to me, but I think the internet does facilitate that, because these folks almost certainly would not have the courage to say something like that to your face if it had societal and social repercussions for them.
Your book includes a vivid scenario that talks about how we tend to downplay abuse in digital spaces. Why don't we take it seriously?
This is something I think about a lot, and there is a broad-based, I would say, minimization of the experience of women online. It can't possibly have an effect on women beyond when they shut down that social media platform or walk away from their device or computer. And that really discounts, A, women's role in society, but B, the psychological experiences that happen on the internet. And anybody who has, you know, seen a disturbing video online, even if it has nothing to do with you, should understand that that can have a very visceral reaction on your psyche, on your physical and emotional well-being. And now imagine if you're being sent death and rape threats, or even just visceral kind of vitriolic harassment from hundreds or thousands of tens or thousands of people over a course of a short period of time. It has absolutely an effect on the way that you move about in the world, particularly if that harassment or threats are coupled with doxing when your personal information is released. And that is something that's happened to me. I've also had the unfortunate experience of being recognized in public by people who, I don't want to say wish me harm, but certainly people who weren't fans of me, who then posted my real-time location on their Twitter profiles. One of the guys had tens of thousands of followers and he posted a picture of me. I think people don't realize that again, especially in the post-pandemic era when we rely on so much for the internet, our social connection, our careers, that it is just absurd to say to people, to women in particular, that you can't use the internet. Like, that's what you're asking of us when you say don't feed the trolls. Okay, let me just shut down all of my social media accounts, completely remove myself from the conversation, whether that's a public conversation or whether I'm just somebody trying to live my life and connect with my family and friends online. You're asking us to remove ourselves from that key part of public life, to not use the affordances that make our lives easier on the internet because of the potential harm that it does. Essentially, what it boils down to is stay at home and raise your kids, right? Because if you're not engaging in the public conversation, if you're not connecting with people, then what are you doing? And that's really scary to me. Our policymakers also discount that. They have not yet bridged the gap between what we see online and kind of the harms caused and the laws that we have for things like stalking, other types of abuse. You know, I've brought cases and opened protective orders against people who have harmed me online, and I'm using statutes that are related to people who have been in domestic violence situations. And I'm lucky that I have judges who can, you know, see that connection, but that's not always the case. Just earlier today, I was talking to a researcher in India who, through an organization called IT for Change, working on a judicial toolkit so that they can help judges in India interpret the legal code there through a feminist lens. They've also done training with law enforcement officers. We need more of that in the United States, frankly, and probably in Canada too. We're just really lagging behind in our understanding of the impact that online abuse, harassment, and other types of victimization have on people's offline existence.
In the research you've done in this area, what are hidden issues that really stand out to you most?
Women of intersectional identities, so who either are, you know, racially diverse, ethnically diverse, religiously diverse, or sexually diverse, experience compounded abuse. Myself, as a white woman, I've experienced some pretty terrible stuff. But if I had been a woman of color or a queer woman, I would have gotten way, way, way worse. In particular, Black women in the United States, they skip over all the quote-unquote niceties of abuse and they go straight for the violent stuff. They go straight to doxing and targeting people's families. You've got a banner right behind you that says, "Until all of us have made it, none of us have made it." And I think it's really important to give voice to those experiences and the fact that we often overlook intersectionality in our conversations about online abuse against women. So that's the first thing. The second thing that I do think is pretty shocking and surprising is how little political will there is among the social media companies where this abuse is taking place to stop the abuse. It is really disconcerting to me that they don't want to do more to make it a safe place for 50% of their users. As a result of this inaction from tech companies, we have a severe gender disparity on the internet. Women don't use the internet as much as men or to the same extent. So on Twitter, and this is an old statistic now, but men got retweeted twice as often as women. On Reddit, which is the homepage, the front page of the internet, 75% of users are men. And there's a reason for that. It's because they're some of the most disgusting, misogynistic diatribes I've ever seen on Reddit. And what that means, again, is that women are just removing themselves from the conversation. They are self-selecting and self-censoring out.
Your book shares some practical tips on what we can personally do to protect ourselves and each other in hostile digital spaces. Can you share some top tips with us now?
The first and most important thing is to think about how you secure your data. I, in some ways, regret that it's the first practical chapter of my book because it's boring. It's just talking about how to change your privacy settings and things like that. But having good passwords, having two-factor authentication on your accounts, and thinking about how you want to remove your personal data from the internet, and there are various services that you can subscribe to that do this for you. You can also do it on your own. It's just quite time-consuming to write these removal requests and learn how to do it for each of the platforms that your personal data might be present on. So I'm talking about ad exchanges and things like this, which are more prevalent in the US than they are in Canada, even affect Europeans, even with GDPR. So it's a thing that we all have to think about. That is the sort of stuff that will keep you physically safe. It will keep people from making sure that they're not impersonating you. It will keep your personal information and kind of anything you don't want public off of the internet. And it will make sure that it is more difficult to dox you. Not impossible, unfortunately, because of public records. I find it very ironic that, you know, all our transparency in the West leads to people who are authoritarian in tendencies using it against us. But that'll make it more difficult for people to dox you and put you and your family at risk. The other stuff I think that's really important is understanding the policies of the platforms that you are choosing to have an account on. Recently, a friend of mine who's an author had, in a long and unfortunate way, a local blog accidentally doxed her. It was a sordid tale, but they kind of refused to take it down and didn't understand the implications of having that picture on the internet. And so I had to walk her through, like, how do we report this tweet? She wasn't aware of the reporting kind of guidelines. And so one of the things that I advocate for in my book is for everybody to understand, again, what are the things that don't fly on a platform? Where do you know and how do you know if it crosses a line? And then what do you do when that line is crossed? And I'm shocked, but not surprised, again, that so many of the women that I speak to across a variety of different fields don't know how to report stuff online or don't take the time to do it. And that might be, again, because of the lack of political will that we spoke about. They know that it's not going to go anywhere or have a feeling that it's not going to go anywhere. But it does send an important signal to the platform that whether intentional or not, this is an account that has broken the rules. It gives them data about what to look for in the future so that they can crack down on the people who are using that malign creativity and trying to get around the rules that we talked about before. In most cases, it doesn't take very long. So there are ways that you can do that. You can have other people do it for you, but it's something that I think is part of being a good online bystander on the internet. And that's not just when it's happening to you. It's about when it's happening to people that you see as well. This one is a bit more proactive and not just defensive, but it's about creating the sort of environment that you want to see online. And this was interesting to see on Threads when people started joining Threads en masse. People were talking about, you know, not reblogging or retweeting, for lack of a better word, the content of the bad actors who were trying to get on Threads. They were like, let's not do that here. Let's not amplify them. Block them immediately. That's going to give important information to Threads. And it was just music to my ears to see that people finally were understanding how the oxygen of amplification works on the internet. If you want to see more diverse women sharing content online, support them, share their content, tell them how much it means to you. And if you see the baddies doing horrible stuff, actively report them, block them, don't engage with them. All of that sounds really important signals, again, to the platforms about the sorts of things that people are finding useful online. And then I think just calling out bad behavior when we see it. And sometimes, you know, this can be done in a way that incentivizes further abuse. And I'm not a big fan of that. So what I like to do, and I talk about this in the book, is shame people, but not do it in a way that amplifies them further. So I tend to take a screenshot. I will blur out, or if I'm on Instagram, kind of X out using the drawing tool, their avatar and their username. And then I make fun of them, which is kind of cathartic for me, but it doesn't give them any amplification. Like I said, it shames them and points out how ridiculous their behavior is. And also is kind of empowering for me and for other women who are looking through this stuff and saying like, wow, I had written a newsletter about my dog who recently died. And it was like an emotional piece about, you know, this being that I spent 11 years with, 11 really important years. And I got so much positive feedback from it of people who really identified with it. And then one man who just wrote, "You are embarrassing." And I thought that that was really interesting. It was kind of, you know, am I the embarrassing one? You're the one that's commenting on somebody's post about their dead dog. I guess you're really not a dog person, right? That sort of thing, I think, can just really flip the script on like, I'm not intimidated by you. I'm not going to give you what you want. I'm not going to take the bait, but I am going to call you out for your bad behavior.
Let me ask you this. What needs to change on a systems level, decision-making and policy and practice?
One of the things that I think needs to happen is better oversight of the platforms. And I'm not just talking about there needs to be a government agency who is telling them what people can and can't post. I don't think that that should happen. But what I do think that should happen is some sort of, you know, we have our federal commissions here that deal with elections or communications. I think there should be a federal internet commission or a federal social media commission that acts as a clearinghouse for data access. So reviews algorithmic decisions that are being made, reviews content moderation decisions, acts as a vetting organization that can decide if researchers get access to certain data so that they can dig through it and make public some of the decisions that are being made by platforms or the effects that they're having on people. Because right now, the way that we're operating is entirely based on whistleblowers and journalists and researchers who are doing things that aren't always in line with, you know, standard data practices or the terms of service of the specific platforms. And we're operating with a small amount of data. ways into the platforms are slowly being closed off, and that allows us to pressure them much, much less than we were before. It's an indirect effect, right? But the more that we get information about how those decisions are being made online, the broader picture we can have and the more accurate picture that we can have about how that stuff affects people offline. I absolutely think we need to pressure lawmakers. I try to have hard conversations whenever I'm in the room with lawmakers, or when I'm writing things now, holding their feet to the fire, really holding them to account because they hold the power. And you can have a bunch of working groups. It's not just lawmakers, but policymakers at other levels as well. The long and short of it is that we just need to keep speaking truth to power. And I wish it didn't have to be something that I'm doing, but it is something that I think can have a tangible impact for women in the future. And so I'm going to keep doing it.
So help us bring this episode home. What takeaway do you want us to leave with?
I think the other thing that is important to know about online abuse and the realities of being a woman online is that we tend to discount our experiences. And it's not until someone else gives them voice or recognizes them that we say, yeah, you know what, that is kind of screwed up and I'm not going to stand for it. I think it's important to talk about this stuff when it's happening. It's important to report it. If you have the resources to report, in particular, you know, sustained abuse, doxing, stalking, et cetera, to law enforcement, it's important to do that as well. And let me tell you, it is exhausting. It is not, again, something I would wish on my worst enemy. I have been going back and forth with my stalker on a protective order for the majority of this year. I view that as also in its own way a form of change, because every officer that I encounter in filing that, every judge that I encounter is going to learn a little bit about what it's like to be a woman on the internet today. And that's going to change the system more broadly for other women in the future. So I encourage folks to talk about stuff, to report it up through the channels as much as they can. Our foremothers, if I may, started talking about the barriers they had at the workplace, and in particular, sexual harassment that was just endemic. This is not part of the job of being a woman online. This is not the cost of raising our voices, because the men in our lives don't have to deal with the same thing. And so we shouldn't stand for it.
All right, now what? Check out How to Be a Woman Online, Surviving Abuse and Harassment and How to Fight Back by Nina Jankowicz, available in book and audio format. Get the facts on gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse by visiting our fact page on CanadianWomen.org. While you're there, read about our new Feminist Creator Prize to uplift feminist digital creators advocating for gender justice, safety, and freedom from harm. Did this episode help you? Did you learn anything new? We want to know. Please visit this episode's show notes to fill out our brief listener survey. You'll be entered to win a special prize pack. This series of podcast episodes has been made possible in part by the Government of Canada. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org.
If I go veil.
Today, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Andre and Max of the Deadly Snakes plugging each other with a peg leg. In Montreal, Andre and Max of the Deadly Snakes.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Back to tough Bonto, I'm having flashbacks of us, no clothes with the sex and the weed combo. I need to see you, girl, Bonto. Come back to tough Bonto, I'm having flashbacks of us, no clothes with the sex and the weed combo.
Bonjour, Montreal. What's going on? It's the R&B Trailblazer K-Force, and I'm just letting you know you can listen to my new song, Thug Passion, from my brand new album, Pray for a Beautiful Sky, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. And you can go get that on Spotify, Apple Music, and Tidal, man. Let's go. Fway out, baby.
I deal with all of the hate, everything that you can imagine.
Digital hate, harassment, and violence hurt so many women, girls, and two-spirit, trans, and non-binary people. Content creators who address gender justice, like Kyron Potts, have a lot to teach us about it. I'm Andrea Gunratch from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What, a podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Whether you're on social media, streaming platforms, dating, messaging, and meeting apps, or on game sites, if you're a woman, girl, or two-spirit, trans, or non-binary person, you're at greater risk of hate, harassment, and violence. Indigenous, Black, and racialized women and 2S LGBTQIA+ people are amongst those who face higher risks. 30% of Indigenous women experience unwanted behavior online. While 8% of cisgender and heterosexual students are targeted for online bullying, harassment, and hate, 27% of LGBTQ female students, 39% of transgender students, and 19% of LGBTQ male students are targeted for the same. Canada's rising hate crimes is in large part due to increased hate in digital spaces against women, 2S LGBTQIA+ people, and targeted ethnic and religious groups. Over coming months, we're delving into this with leading experts and content creators, releasing in-depth episodes every single week. We talk about the problem and what we can do to change it. We offer practical tips to help you in your digital life. And we talk about what it means to take back the tech for all of us. We're joined by Kyron Potts, proudly Nakota Swee from Treaty 6 Territory, Paul First Nation, and the Alexis Nakota Swee Nation. He's a proud Two-Spirit person and sits as the National Youth Board representative for the Two Spirits in Motion Society. As a former Indigenous Youth Suicide Prevention Team representative, he's a passionate advocate to improve Indigenous young people's lives, especially queer youth and youth in the child and family services system. Kyron is a writer, actor, model, and TV host, and continues advocacy through content creation, workshops, and community events. He's host of Snapchat Canada's Reclaimed series and has appeared in the APTN series 7th Gen. Kyron co-founded the Indigenous gaming organization Nietzsche Clan and is an avid gamer and streamer on Twitch and TikTok. He uses his platform to share his culture, makeup and fashion, his passions like gaming and acting, and laughs with other people. A note about content. This episode addresses gender-based violence and suicide.
I am an experience. First and foremost. Second, let me say, Abawashtano, Kyron Potts Magapchat, Alexis Nakota, Sioux Nation Chadeha Himuchat, Tanse, Okisukukanamitu, Nimiwin, and Skujioskai Kanote Nia. I like to introduce myself in both of my languages just because I have to. It's truly the best way, I think, to introduce who I am. I am Kyron Potts, he, him pronouns. I come from Treaty 6 territory, humbly, from the Alexis Nakota Sioux Nation and also from Paul First Nation. I was born and raised in Edmonton and currently am making my home for the last 3 years in beautiful Tekaronto, Dish with One Spoon Treaty territory over here. I'm a guest in these lands and I am a full-time content creator. I'm a writer. I am a TV host, a model, and a Twitch streamer, a live streamer for video games. I kind of do it all, you know, I'm a youth advocate, social worker as well.
How do you personally deal with gendered hate, harassment, and abuse as a person of influence?
I deal with all of the hate, everything that you can imagine. Everything from the really ugly comments on my videos to straight up just physical violence in the real world. Based on who I am, and pretty much for no other reason than just existing as a queer person, as a gender diverse person, as somebody that doesn't really ascribe to the gender binary, or somebody who exists kind of in this in-between space that really makes a lot of people uncomfortable. So yeah, I deal with it on a near day-to-day, not even near, an absolutely day-to-day basis. In fact, it was a great opportunity to talk about what happened yesterday. I had this this man who has just been bombarding my videos with just the most hate speech, the just vitriol, just venom. He left me probably 20 different comments telling me, you know, everything from, you know, I'm going to burn in hell and my ancestors are embarrassed of me and I don't speak for all Native people. Granted, this was a cisgender heterosexual Native man, older, who works in the community. And it's really important to bring this up because it goes to show you that like violence and hatred and harm doesn't just come from people outside of our communities. It comes from our own people all the time. And it's this lateral violence is happening so often from people that you're not expecting it from. And I think that that's when it starts to hurt a little bit more, is when it comes from people who you're not used to defending yourself from, people that you think understand you and that you think are your community. At a certain point, you know, you have to block them and delete them and do all those things necessary. Here's one thing about me, though, and not everybody agrees with this, and that's totally fine, but I am a double Gemini two-spirit troublemaker for the longest time, since I was 4 years old and was even old enough to be able to, like, choose how I dress and what I want to do. I have been this person, the cool hair and the jewelry and the makeup and the clothes and the da-da-da. Never once have I ever not been that person. And so you can imagine growing up, there was a lot of bullying, and I am no stranger to defending myself against the harshness of the world. I learned that right out the womb. You know what I mean? So now that I'm 30 and I'm not a child anymore, I'm so healed in so many areas of my life when it comes to my identity. I no longer feel the need to just get by. I'm not trying to just survive anymore. I am at a place where I'm so secure in my identity that I'm trying to create space. It's not about me just getting by day to day and looking out for number one. It's about me realizing I'm totally secure in who I am, and none of these comments are hurting me. Now I'm looking out for the younger generation. I'm looking out for my nieces and my nephews. I'm looking out for the people who don't have the same level of spiritual fortitude and protection and barriers and supports in place. When I have hard days, I have six people off the top of my head who I can go to, that I do go to constantly, to help me with this level of violence that I receive. And I regulate all of it by leaning on people that support me. And there are so many young people who don't have that. That's where my head is at. But to answer the question, I respond sometimes with the same energy. And whether that's right or wrong, it just happens. And I want to talk about it because it's a real thing that happens. It's the truth, and it's human. Nobody gets to tell me how I get to respond to people telling me to die. Nobody gets to police my responses to extreme violence, hatred, for nothing else than me just existing. We're all on this rock together, floating through space. I'm just trying to breathe, eat, and have fun in the meantime, and be myself. And that's all I'm asking. I'm not going after people's kids and telling them to be gay. I'm not going after children and telling them to be transgender. I am existing. That's all I'm doing. I'm existing in a place where there's not a lot of room for me. If that is enough for me to be the target of so much hatred, then I'm sorry, but I'm not the kind of person to take it lying down a lot. I do have the time every once in a while in my day to give people a little taste of their own medicine. And I'm not talking about just arguing with them online. I'm talking about, I'm calling people's jobs sometimes. I'm filing grievances with human resources, and I'm letting people know that the stuff that they do online has real consequences in real life. And I'm not just talking about them maybe getting a slap on the wrist or getting a suspension or losing their job or whatever. I'm talking about their comments will kill somebody. If they're telling me I should get scalped because I'm gay, if they're telling me I should hang myself with my sweater, if they're telling me all of these things, they don't know what kind of situation I'm in mentally. Those comments could 100% be the nail in my coffin. And for many young people, it is. If you're proudly promoting that you're the head of, you know, marketing for this big corporation and you spend your free time bullying and spreading hatred and hate speech, cyberbullying young kids into committing suicide, you need to have consequences for that kind of behavior. That shows like a character flaw in your person. So in any space that you go in, no one is going to be safe, whether it's in your job or whether it's on the sidewalk or whatever. And so I'm gonna take it a step further and I'm going to call it out and let them know, hey, this has to stop. What you're doing is not okay. And then I call in the allies. I call in the non-queer people who work with them, who are like, they also agree, hey, this isn't okay. And so I feel like if in situations like that, if enough people come around them and are kind of like letting them know this is unacceptable, maybe they'll change their mind. Maybe it might make them think twice. Probably not. In my experience, people like that don't just change overnight. But hey, it's 5 minutes of my time to make a quick phone call or an email. And if it leads to something happening in their organization where maybe they'll think twice about giving people access to the internet or whatever, then it's worth it. But for the most part, I have to just block and move on to preserve not only my mental health, but like I said, it's those young people who follow me and who are always in my comment section cheering me on. I don't want them to see random adults telling me to kill myself because they see a lot of themselves in me. If they're reading those comments and seeing that a lot of people are, you know, hating on me or whatever, calling for my downfall, that's going to harm them. And it's not going to harm me. It's going to harm them babies. So that's what I'm always thinking about, is them kids.
I want to circle back to the issue of lateral violence you spoke to. I don't think we talk about this nearly enough when we talk about issues of digital abuse. Can you share what that means to you and how you see it in your experiences?
Lateral violence happens when there are a group of marginalized, oppressed people. They're so beaten down and brainwashed and hurt that they no longer remember who's hurting them, and they stop trying to fight the enemy above them, and they start looking side to side and hurting the people next to them. And it's just collateral damage. That's inherently what colonization and what the structure of colonization has really done to so many people around the world, so many indigenous people around the world. But speaking specifically to my community in North America, and specifically in, like, even in my nation in Treaty 6 territory, growing up there my whole life and seeing firsthand, walking through these communities as somebody who looks, sounds, and moves like I do, I was at the forefront of so much of the symptoms of colonization that manifested into extreme lateral violence in so many different ways. A lot of it comes from misogyny, patriarchy, toxic masculinity. Really, truly, it comes from a place of the church and of Western ideals of what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, what gender is, what sex is, what it isn't, and what it can't be. These beliefs from the Catholic Church and from white supremacy that have been literally forced into our communities via a vehicle of genocide and murder and of raping and of pillaging and of all of these things. What it has done to our beliefs has completely changed it. And colonization is such a structure and not just a singular event, that now it's so deep rooted into our people. And it went after a lot of our men. So many of our men have subscribed to this idea of what it means to be a man at the expense of women and gender diverse people. I don't think that many of them understand that they can still be warriors. They can still be powerful and brave and strong, and that they don't need to step on the heads of women and of gender diverse people in order to raise themselves up to feel that sense of identity. You need to look no further than all of the teachings we have about our women and about our two-spirit people and our queer, gender diverse relatives in history, and look at the teachings that they have there about so many different nations and tribes and communities who celebrated women as leaders. Many women were chiefs, celebrating Two-Spirit people as healers and mediators and of child rearers and of really important ceremonial people in the community. Where did that all go? It died with many of their identity and their self-love. I don't blame them. I don't blame, for example, Native men for the harm that they've perpetrated against not only just myself and other Indigenous queer people, but to women as well. I see it all the time in our communities. In fact, it's become a meme. Where it comes from is these men see somebody like me living my entire truth, living in my power and in living free of shackles, of expectation of what I need to be. And they look at me and it's a direct attack on them because they don't love themselves and they're not honest with themselves. And they live every single day wasting and utilizing energy on what they think they have to be. And for many of them, it's be strong. Don't show any emotions. Don't cry. You're not allowed to like pink because it's for girls. You have to do that. Like, so many rules and so many barriers and chains and shackles. I'm asking them to free themselves too. I'm saying, look, I exist. This is what the possibility could be for you. And it doesn't need to look like me. You don't need to look like me. You be you. You do you the way you want to do you, and don't let anybody tell you how to be you. Lateral violence really comes from there. It really stems from all of these teachings that are foreign. They do not belong at all to our communities. Homophobia has absolutely no place in Indigenous culture and actively goes against the teachings of so many of our elders. That's what I have to say about lateral violence. It's just such a... It's such a multifaceted, multi-layered problem, and there is no right answer or no overnight solution. It's so, like I said, layered and complex, and it involves so much of the work that people like me and people like you do in our communities to be talking about this and raising awareness and coming up with solutions. But it really involves a lot of the men too, who perpetrate a lot of this lateral violence and this hatred against us. It involves them. And it involves bringing them in a good way that I think isn't aggressive. And we need to lead with what we're good at, which is being gentle and being those in-between people, being people who can mediate really complex ideas and giving them a safe place to be like, you know what? I love you. You're beautiful. Your masculinity is beautiful. Because masculinity is beautiful. I'm saying toxic masculinity, I do not like. I didn't say anything about regular, healthy masculinity.
You're making me wonder about what it would mean to decolonize our digital spaces, just like we have to take decolonizing action in other spaces. What does decolonizing our online spaces mean to you?
Being a full-time content creator now for going on 3 years, I've had so much experience watching many of my things go viral and then many of my content reach like 2 people. So I've seen everything and in between and watched many of my friends and close relatives have their content do what it needs to do. What I've really taken from it is that I really believe that these online spaces, although they are all online and they're different inherently, I find that they mirror society so much and that many of the things that I try to teach allies about in real life, it completely makes sense and applies to digital spaces as well. One of the biggest ways that I think we can decolonize being online is putting an end to so many of our narratives and our truths being hijacked and being taken from us and being told without us for profit a lot of the time. And that many of our voices and our storytellers and our leaders and our artists who are the keepers of these stories and all of this beautiful expression, they're the ones being railroaded and they're not being given credit. I'm seeing so many accounts pop up just blatantly stealing content so that they can sell crappy made overseas random merchandise with eagles and slogans on it for ridiculous prices, cashing in on Every Child Matters, Orange Shirt Day, MMIW2SG, like red hand logo merchandise. Just disgusting, you know, and as if Indigenous people haven't dealt with enough, but now we can't even like bring up anything without just wicked non-Indigenous corporations coming in and making a quick penny off of the trauma of Indigenous people. So one great way to decolonize these spaces is to call out that injustice when it happens, to put an end to it, to be mass reporting these accounts. I love when allies who are non-Indigenous create posts of their own, taking what they've learned from creators like myself. I give a ton of who I am, but I give a ton of what I've learned from my community and my worldview to my followers for free all the time, constantly. And they learn a lot from me. And I get tagged in the cutest posts where it's like, hey, today I went out and visited my local reserve and I made a donation of 25 ribbon skirts to this organization because O'Kyron told me that many people don't have access to that. And so I used my privilege to go and do this. And I think decolonizing starts really in our own backyards. I don't like when people try to make these really grand gestures of systemic change overnight. It's not realistic. Do the most with what you have and never, ever underestimate the power of planting that little seed and watching that grow into something. Are you even following any Indigenous people? Where are you getting your news sources from? Who are you? Whose voices are you prioritizing and uplifting? Because if you're interacting on these algorithms, looking for Indigenous content, and none of the content that you're consuming or liking or sharing or commenting on or reposting is by Indigenous people, then you are a part of the problem and you are contributing to this system that has continuously stolen and appropriated. Even for like Two-Spirit people, there's just like this wave of like non-Indigenous people appropriating this Two-Spirit identity and coming up with this whole new identity. And you know what? It makes it so much more difficult for somebody like me to be like, hi, everyone, I'm a Two-Spirit person. People are like, well, Two-Spirit is a brand new thing that you guys just created last year and da-da-da-da-da. It's because that term is being railroaded and taken from us and they're running off with it and doing whatever they want with it. And so I always tell people, if we're going to decolonize, let's center, create space, and hold space for women, for femme people, for queer identifying people. And let's make space for our Native men in a good way and let their truths and their stories be heard too. I think that's a great way to decolonize.
Any tips or advice you would share with our listeners worried about unsafe digital spaces and not quite sure about how to make things better?
There are people who are even afraid to post good things, much less come at somebody and confront them for injustice. They're scared to share a picture of their brand new puppy that they got because they're scared of being perceived in any kind of way, whether it's good or bad. It's tough for me to put myself in their shoes because I live my life so much online and I just really don't care what people think. But it took a long time for me to get to the place where I'm like, say what you want to say about me, perceive me however you want. I'm still going to live my life. I think one kind of interesting sort of mechanism that they can use is just thinking, and this kind of goes back to decolonizing a little bit, but like seeing these spaces as community spaces. Like when you look at one of the people who you've been following for 4 years on the internet, who you love all of their posts, you interact with them a lot, kind of see them as like your next door neighbor. And if you see someone coming onto their lawn and shooting their house up with a gun, you're going to call the police. You're going to want to help them. You don't need to go out there and tackle the gunman. Your courage could be hiding in your room, making a phone call to the police or whoever to try to get this person to stop. Whether you whisper or whether you yell, speaking up against these kinds of things doesn't need to be always a massive, courageous event. And think about some ways that you can help, even little things like reporting comments. Those do help. People don't think that they do, but there are systems in place where like certain keywords can get deleted if they're hate messages. And now even like apps like Instagram and Facebook, they give you a notification when your report has led to some type of action against that account that's being, you know, really awful. It kind of reminds me of this story that I learned from an elder, and it's such a cute story. Basically, there was this forest fire. It was raging and burning, and everyone's homes were lighting up in flames, and all the animals were running out of the forest, frantically trying to escape these flames. All of them finally made it to the end of the forest, and they went out into the clearing and turned around and watched their home just burning, and they felt so helpless. And as they're all running out, they see a little hummingbird, a little tiny hummingbird, come flying the opposite direction, flying right into the flames. And they're wondering, like, what are you doing? You're going to get killed. The hummingbird stops right at the edge of the fire and spits the tiniest little water out of her beak. And they go, what are you doing? And she goes, well, I don't know about you guys, but this is what I can do, and I'm doing it. She can only carry so much water, but that's what she can do. That's the capacity that she's showing up with, and she's making a difference in the way that she can. And that's totally how I feel about, you know, people who are online in these communities. It's like, you don't need to be everything. Your support can be whatever you can do. And that's important, and it's worth it. And it's valid.
Any other tips you would share with people at high risk of harm in digital spaces from your perspective as a content creator?
The biggest thing that I try to tell people is recognize that when you wake up in the morning, people aren't going to like you. They're going to hate you. There's absolutely nothing you can do about it. That frees you from so many expectations of yourself right off the bat. The second thing I tell people is to take so many breaks. Even somebody like me who makes a living online, I try to tell my friends, they're constantly on their phone too. And they're like, how can I do more? How can I do more? I'm like, you need to recognize you have a 9-to-5 job. You need to dedicate your life to your career and to taking care of yourself. I am online all the time because this is literally my 9-to-5 job. We're not online in the same way. So don't expect yourself to be doing internet and doing social media the same way that all of these influencers that you follow are doing the internet. The difference is they're making a living doing it. It's not your job. You use it for the ways that empower you. Connect with people, learn art, make yourself laugh, make yourself cry, give yourself support. Like all of the things that you want to use social media for, connecting with your friends, planning things, whatever. Do that and enjoy it, and make sure that you're enjoying your time on social media. And when it starts becoming a lot and it starts being hurtful and you start logging in and your stomach drops and you feel sad and you feel angry and you're feeling all these frustrations and this general body chaos just from looking at your phone and interacting with social media, it's time to just stop interacting with social media. You have so much power to just not engage. No one's holding a gun to your head to go and read all of these awful, awful headlines. We exist in this age now where young people have been exposed so much to so much tragedy and heartbreak at any given moment, more than any other generation in the entire history of the world. We never have had this much access to tragedy, to all of the terrible things that are happening in the world. So imagine our brain chemistry, how much it's changed as young people being able to, at a finger's touch, know about, you know, 6 million people dying on the other side of the world. This is just so overwhelming sometimes. My phone will die on a trip and I have no charger anywhere. We're kind of out in the bush and I'm supposed to be filming content. After like 2 hours of not having my phone even turn on, I realize I'm like, that was a really good 2 hours. How de-stressed and relieved I felt. I'm like, damn, I got to do this more often. I need to schedule, turn off my phone time. You know, the world is still going to exist. When you turn social media back on, guess what? Nothing's going to change. It's going to be the same thing that it was last month and the month before and the month before. You may feel like you're missing out on stuff, but you're really not. And it's not worth going into a spiral. Let's just take it a step by step. Like I said, start in your own backyard. We're doing the most that we can with what we got, and it's okay to turn it off and take breaks. And also just honestly surround yourself with good people. You are who you surround yourself with. If you know that you don't like somebody and you follow them, just unfollow them. It's not even more complex than that. If you're scared that you unfollowing them is going to make that person dislike you or cause confrontation, that's not a really good relationship anyway. Let's start being more honest with who we keep in our safe spaces.
All right, now what? Check out Kyron Potts on Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, Twitch, and more. at O'Kyron. Get the facts on gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse by visiting our fact page on CanadianWomen.org. While you're there, read about our new Feminist Creator Prize to uplift feminist digital creators advocating for gender justice, safety, and freedom from harm. Did this episode help you? Did you learn anything new? We want to know. Please visit this episode's show note to fill out our brief listener survey. You'll be entered to win a special prize pack. This series of podcast episodes has been made possible in part by the Government of Canada. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit Canadian.
Yes, 1212. Oh yeah, see, Nomadic Massive in the place to be. You're listening to CKUT 90.3. Understand.
What's the matter? Is everything all right? That's okay. I've got just the right thing for you. CKUT
T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked at the CKT 90.3 FM.